greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, way past 21. I want you to leave me, baby. I have lots of fun. I'm a man. I spell him.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about olive oil, the key to helping cancer, from the Journal of Molecular and Cellular Oncology, and from Greek University, Mediterranean diet cuts heart disease risk by nearly half, how turmeric can help prevent a stroke, and polysorbate 80 and other emulsifiers found in foods and vaccines alter your gut microbes, leading to inflammatory conditions. Not good at all there. Also, we'll talk about eat at your own risk. We're going to have a guest in the second part of our program, Dr. Peter Mansu. He is a scholar, religious scholar, one of the finest in the world. He's received many awards, including the National Jewish Book Award, the Sophie Brody Medal, the Ribolo Prize, the National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship, and he is also co-founder of the religious blog KillingTheBuddha.com with Jeff Charlotte. He received his doctorate in religion from Georgetown University, and he is currently curating an exhibit of America's diverse religious past for the Smithsonian National Museum of American History. His book is One Nation Under God's A New American History. We're going to talk about a subversive reevaluation of the history of religion in the United States and evidence that it should not be regarded solely as a Christian nation. Please hand a bottle or two of Prozac to Sean Hannity. It'll shock him. Also, a lot of information today on the environment. A mega drought, that's what the scientists are saying, now is happening to our coral reefs. Well, how in the world can you have a drought in the ocean? You can, because the mega drought causes the disappearance of coral reefs, and we're not listening. Why aren't we? Dar Jamil, the planet's lungs are dying. I'll talk about photosynthesis. Why you should never microwave your food. And more information today on something that's been concerning me for about 6-7 years. And that is Greenland. The latest reports from Bruce Melton on Truthout about Greenland is warmer today than it has been in 100,000 years. And it's creating disrupting feedback loops. It's already begun. How bad is it? Well, it's a lot worse than what the people thought. The so-called experts, not to worry. Won't it happen in your lifetime or 10 lifetimes? Really? Could you explain then how we just found out that since the year 2000, ice loss has increased by over 600%? And liquid water now exists inside the ice sheet that's 2 miles thick year-round. It no longer freezes in the winter. Well, that's not good. And they've just discovered with special equipment tunnels under the ice. 11,000-foot thick ice sheet, and now you've got all these tunnels. How big are the tunnels? How far are they? What does it mean? Well, it means you're going to have collapsing. And when you have collapsing, you're going to have massive calving, unlike anything we've ever seen. And did they tell you about the 27,000 square mile surprise in the southern Greenland ice sheet? Bet not. We will. The most definitive program in radio on the environment, and we'll show you why you should pay attention to this today. But I'm going to start our program today with something that the pro-vaccine people would not be happy if you knew. It comes from a peer-reviewed journal, the American Journal of Reproductive Immunology. And it's volume 70, page 309 to 316. The article is entitled Human Papillomavirus Vaccine and Primary Ovarian Failure, Another Facet of the Autoimmune Inflammatory Syndrome Induced by Adjuvants, by a group of scientists. Let me quote verbatim, and then I'll explain, if it's a little too technical, what it means in lay language. Quote, the problem, post-vaccination autoimmune phenomena are a major facet of the autoimmune inflammatory syndrome induced by adjuvants and different vaccines, including the human papillomavirus, have been identified as possible causes. Then it goes on to talk about methods of the study, but here's the conclusion. This is what's important. Quote, we documented here the evidence of the potential of the human papillomavirus vaccine to trigger a life-disabling autoimmune condition. The increasing number of similar reports of post-human papillomavirus vaccine-linked autoimmunity and the uncertainty of long-term clinical benefits of the human papillomavirus vaccination are a matter of public health that warrants further rigorous inquiry, end quote. Okay, what does that mean in lay language, and why is this so important? Because we have been saying, and we showed in a series of articles, fully documented and footnoted, and also in the documentary, The Silent Epidemic, and if you haven't watched it, it's free, watch it. Go to GaryNoll.com or my the YouTube, and you can see the entire documentary. That you have completely healthy young girls, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. They're getting three human papillomavirus vaccines, and tens of thousands are going into critical care, dying, neurological damage, paralysis, seizures, a whole spectrum of conditions, all because we are told that this will help protect them from a cancer decades in the future. But there was never proof that this was anything other than a hypothesis of a mathematical model. It cannot withstand any criticism. Even Dr. Diane Harper, one of the lead investigators on this originally, has stated so on the record to us in our film and on this radio program that this was oversold by the manufacturers. Now, through the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, with lobbying at the local and state level, they're trying to mandate it. So your child would have no choice. You would have no choice, but your child would have to be given these, the most expensive vaccines in the world, by the way. And so we can now show, and this is not the first article, by the way, from a major peer-reviewed journal that is creating autoimmune, post-vaccination autoimmune phenomena. And it's causing massive inflammation, including brain inflammation. And why? Because they call it, quote, the adjuvants. What are adjuvants? Aluminum, an adjuvant. Polysorbate 80, an adjuvant. Formaldehyde, these are adjuvants. But the worst of them all is aluminum. It's highly neurotoxic. So if you're wondering, is there really good science to challenge using this vaccine, the answer is unequivocally, absolutely, yes. This is a fraudulent vaccine. This is murdering, and the people, the manufacturers, the state legislators, those who publicize it mercilessly on television should be held accountable in the public domain. They can't be legally for crimes against humanity. They're killing young girls. So stand up and say no. And we need a special investigator on this. This really now goes into the area of the RICO actions. Separately, from Ethan Huff, Natural News, quote, flu vaccine paradox spreading globally as more vaccinated people catch the flu. The conventional medical system is literally grasping at straws, trying to maintain the illusion that vaccines work, with new reports now admitting that flu vaccines are an utter failure while still pushing people to get them. The latest on these from the Canadian government attributes all the inconsistencies between the what the authorities have long claimed about the alleged efficacy of the flu shot and its actual dismal, proven lack of efficacy. And they're calling it, quote, a mysterious paradox. Well, there's nothing mysterious about it, and there's no paradox to it. There's simply no leg that orthodoxy has to stand on. It is now in the scientific literature that the flu shot is minimally effective at best. They're resorting to more confusing pseudoscience that, oddly enough, actually affirms what flu shot skeptics have surmised for many years. Vaccines in general, they now reluctantly admit, affect every person differently. And depending upon what previous vaccinations a person's had, flu shots may or may not provide any protection at all. And in some cases, they make you more prone to illness. Quote, people who receive flu vaccines year after year can sometimes show reduced protection, an effect that Canadian infectious disease specialists say muddies public health messages about annual flu vaccines, end quote. And then it goes on to say, quote, during the H1N1 2009 pandemic, researchers at the BC Center for Disease Control originally thought seasonal flu shots from 2008 might offer extra protection against new pandemic. They were puzzled to find instead seasonal flu vaccination almost doubled the risk of infection with pandemic flu. Hence, those who got the extra flu shot were more likely to get the flu. So that is where we stand on that. Once again, if you look at the actual science and not listen to the hyperbole and the personal attacks of those who challenge the science of flu giving the vaccines, you'll see the truth. We'll keep bringing it to you. Next week, we have a investigative journalist coming on talking about what they found out when they looked into how the World Health Organization has for a long time been using the poor of Africa to test highly toxic, very dangerous vaccines without any qualms whatsoever. That person will be on our program exclusively, sharing new information exclusively. Now, to good news. And one of the reasons that I'm sure some people tune in every day to this program is because it empowers you. You want to live a longer and healthier life. You want to be able to make better choices. And we know that one of the things that we all have to do, we have to eat. But if we eat intelligently, if we eat as if we really cared about the consequences to the eating, not just satisfying some emotional feeling. I want a hamburger. I want a pizza. It's 11 o'clock at night. I want to go something, but you're going to be asleep in an hour, and it's still going to be in your stomach when you wake up in the morning. It's going to adversely affect your sleep, and it's going to create inflammation. I don't care. I want it now. We have to, at some point, just say enough. You don't have another lifetime to make bad choices. So you better start making really smart choices from here on out. And we can do that with our diet. There's a major study at a Herkopoio University in Greece, and they wanted to study the Mediterranean diet. Quote, adults who closely followed the Mediterranean diet were 47% less likely to develop heart disease over a 10-year period compared to similar adults who did not closely follow the diet. 47%. Mind you, that does not take into account had you taken supplements, vitamin C, vitamin E, tocotrienols, PPQ, coenzyme Q10, NADH. All of those help lessen your likelihood of having heart disease. Exercising every day. That's not including stress management every day. That's not included. Just the diet. So what it means is for people who may not have made the best choices up to this point in their life, you can reverse a lot of the damage that's been done and go forward from this day on adding years, even decades, onto your life. So that's good news. And they talked about, the what goes into the diet, and we already know all that. We've studied it. We've talked about it extensively. They eat slow, by the way. They take their time, but they really load up on olives and olive oil, nuts and beans, whole grains, vegetables, lots of fruits, and fish, and red wine. That's the Mediterranean diet. And everywhere I've gone in studying the Mediterranean diet in the Mediterranean, I see a reduced risk of diabetes. When you speak with people, they don't have the high blood pressure, they don't have the high cholesterol, and they have a reduced risk of heart disease, even though there's a lot of smoking there. Quote, because the Mediterranean diet is based upon food groups that are quite common or easy to find, people around the world could easily adapt this dietary pattern and help protect themselves against heart disease with very little cost. That's the chief author of the study. This was also confirmed when they looked at 75,000 American nurses over a 30-year period and found that it made all the difference in the world. That study, entitled, quote, Adherence to Mediterranean is the Most Important Protector Against the Development of Fatal and Non-Fatal Cardiovascular Events, 10-year follow-up, 2002-2012, of the Attica study. And that was presented at the American College of Cardiology. So, once again, you do not find the American diet in alignment with health at all. If anything, everything that the average American consumes contributes to inflammation and disease. But we could turn it around. Individually, we could turn it around, and are. Millions and millions of people are doing that. By the way, I posted today, among all the articles, I posted one showing a really, really neat storefront. It was very cute. It was like an old-fashioned general store where someone had taken the time and the artistry to do it out of wood and something you'd have seen in the 1800s. But it was all about wholesome food, and they had baskets outside tiered up with the different vegetables and fruits in it and hardwood floor. Really cool looking. And that is what I believe we're going to be seeing a great many people doing. Moving towards a more wholesome way of presenting food, because the two biggest issues in our future are going to be the food and the water. We're running out of water, and we're going to have a shortage of food for a lot of the people in the world, not if you have money, for probably realistically 50 million Americans. They won't have a problem with either, because they have the financial resources to get whatever they want. There'll always be a supply, it's just can you afford it? But for all the other people, it'll be a struggle. So it's good to see that people are waking up, because 20 years ago, that store would have failed. I even remember this little story. A friend of mine founded Fairway, Dave, with some of his friends. And I used to supply Dave with some of his organic produce. In fact, all of his organic produce. And it didn't work. And one day I went in, I said, how's it going, Dave? And I was growing it upstate, bringing it down from the Fertiller farm. And he said, Gary, he said, I don't understand it. Here you have beautiful, organic, local, fresh lettuce, and I had to drop it down to 40 cents a head. My regular California lettuce that's sprayed with pesticides is a dollar a head. Half price, and I can't give this stuff away. So he just, at that point, he stopped. He tried, but it didn't work. And I thought to myself, why is it when organic is half the price of regular and it's local grown, why won't people buy it? And that puzzled me for a long time, until I would later understand people get into habits And it's the habit and discomfort of giving up a habit, even when the habit is bad. And also, if they don't really know about something, if they're not educated about it, they're not going to try it. So as a newer generation came along that was into organic and sustainable, then they were more likely to try it. And indeed, there was a whole renaissance in the organic movement. And that's what we see today. The vast majority of people going into stores, food co-ops, you'll have some educated older people, but the vast majority are younger people who are hip, aware, educated, and that they want. And especially the biggest single class of people buying and sporting healthy foods, young mothers. Absolutely. And this I can tell you from firsthand experience, because I know how much they buy compared to, let's say, the other people coming in and what they're buying. Oh, they go out of their way to buy their organic baby foods and juices and special waters. They want their kid not to have toxins in their body, and rightly so. But there's a whole lot of them, so it's spreading. And then those children start to grow up, and then they become more aware of organic. Organic is growing. Right now, if I could suggest one thing, if you want to get out of what you're doing, start moving into sustainable hydroponics. It's the future. It's absolutely the future. We have more people wanting healthy, wholesome foods than we have those foods to offer. So there's a greater demand than there is a supply. Now, another thing that we don't have enough of, healthy quality olive oil. Be very conscious about the olive oil that you eat, because a lot of it coming into this country is adulterated. Try to go for brands that guarantee that it's certified, organic, extra virgin, and it should be darker. Do not buy light olive oil, because it's more often than not, that could be soybean oil. This is from the Journal of Molecular and Cellular Oncology. This is a mainstream journal. Quote, extra virgin olive oil, long known for its heart-healthy benefits, has now been identified for its rapid destruction of cancer cells. While scientists have proven that the compound found in the olive oil causes cell death in cancer cells, they've been unable to provide an explanation for this phenomenon until now. And then it goes into a paper that explains this, of what's in the olive oil that very quickly kills cancer cells. Where the cells store waste, it ruptures the cancer cell lysosomes, causing cell death within 30 minutes to an hour while leaving uncancer cells unharmed. This suggests that the lysosomal membranes of cancer cells are weaker than those of uncancer cells. How about that? That's really cool. So, olive oil, which many of you are using, but make sure you're getting a really good brand that you can taste the olive oil if it's really good. And also eating olives. I try to have olives at every meal. And you can cut them up into pieces and put them in your sauces. You can put them in your salads. You can do a paste with them and add in some sun-dried tomatoes and some raw onion and sea salt, and do that as a nice dip, and do a vegetable dip or a rice cracker dip. But olives, killing cancer cells, and that's terrific. Dietary fat increases vitamin D absorption. This is from the latest research out of Boston. Well, we've known this for a long time. This was done at Tufts University. What they're saying is, if you have an oil, like a good quality dietary fat, avocado oil, flaxseed oil, hemp oil, any of the quality omega-3 fatty acids, and you're going to have a higher utilization and absorption of your vitamin D3. That's why when you're taking your supplements, you take them all together in the morning. Always make sure that one of those supplements, maybe turmeroids, the curcuminoids from turmeric, the oil is in there, and that'll help absorption. Taking vitamin E. If you take a vitamin E, that'll help your vitamin D3 get better absorbed. So a little bit of oil, and your vitamin D is better absorbed. Now, for people suffering from Alzheimer's, some good research from the Institute of Neuroscience and Medicine in Zurich, Germany, quote, turmeric, that's the yellow spices in curry, can help stroke and Alzheimer's. And they're not looking at a large amount. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Stem Cell and Research and Therapy. So, quote, our findings of aromatic turmerinone take us one step closer to achieving this goal, and that is to helping people. So let me put this in lay language. We know that turmeric, which includes the healing compound curcumin, C-U-R-C-U-M-I-N, is what really does the job. It will help heal peptic ulcers, irritable bowel syndrome, indigestion, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, gastroesophageal gut syndrome. So it does a lot of good, but it also is good when it comes to helping your brain, turning off inflammation in the brain. So that's multiple sclerosis, ALS, dementia, memory loss, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. And finally, polysorbate 80. It's an emulsifier. You find it in a lot of pharmaceuticals, but it's in most of the vaccines. And it's been found to negatively affect the immune system. Researchers writing in the most important scientific publication in the world, Nature, have now found that they also can see where the polysorbate 80 can alter our gut microbiota composition and driving metabolic changes that lead to inflammatory conditions. So, one more reason why we should be concerned about what goes into vaccines, because polysorbate 80 is destructive to your microbiome, which is your microflora in the gut. And this was done at Georgia State University. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break, come back, and go to our guest who is standing by. We have a whole lot more to share with you, ways that we can live a longer and healthier life. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Dr. Peter Manceau from Maryland talking about the subversive reevaluation of the history of religion in the United States and evidence that it should not be regarded solely as a Christian nation, coming up in a few moments. But I did want to, before we go there, I wanted to give the latest on our environmental segment. First up, I'm concerned because we've been led to believe that any climate changes will be so long in coming that it's not going to impact us directly. Well, in the last 5 years, we are having between 8,000 to 14,000 unique or exceptional environmental impacts per year. That means the hottest of the hot, the coldest of the cold, the worst flooding, the worst tornado, the largest hurricane, whatever it may be. And worldwide, it's over 120,000. So it's not in some of the lifetime. We're getting hit with it now. And anyone experiencing the frigid conditions coming down from the Arctic knows how bad it is. So we're now in what is known as chaos theory. And meaning there is no accurate mathematical model. Once any system begins to fail, and then it starts to create false loops, meaning you can no longer predict it. It's disrupting its own feedback loops. And I'm of the belief that I would rather make moves now to help people. And if we're ahead of that curve, great. But what if we're right? Then we are protecting people. So when it comes to Greenland, you have one of the second largest body of fresh water in the world. Greenland is huge. It's the size of Mexico. It's almost three times the size of Texas. And it's got 2 miles worth of thick ice on it. And we thought it would be there forever, but now we realize that it's the warmest it's been in 100,000 years. And this has created climate-disrupting feedback loops. And they've accelerated since 2000. In fact, there's a 600% increase in ice loss. That's a whole lot of water that's going into the oceans, and that's causing the oceans to rise. But the problem is not just that. The problem is what they're seeing. They're seeing parts of the top highest points that are not freezing in the coldest part of the winter. They're finding with special ice-penetrating technology, gigantic aquifers underneath the ice, and they're liquid 12 months a year. They're also finding tunnels, and with this increased resolution technology, they can see what's beneath the ice. And we have known for decades that the weight of the 10,000-foot ice sheet has depressed the center of Greenland below the sea level. Now, why is that important? Because when you're below the sea level, that means the sea itself comes in and that water is warm. And remember, as long as you got water, it's above freezing. And so now you got warm water at the base, and the weight keeps sinking it, so you get more and more water. And then you get these tunnels. And these tunnels are all over the place. They're growing and growing. And then they saw how far back has it moved in one of the glaciers. This is what is called the Jacobichen Glacier, one of the fastest and most prolific ice sheet discharge points in Greenland. It became the fastest glacier in the world by moving 10 miles in a single year. Well, for glaciers to move 10 miles in a year, that's just unheard of. That's what's happening. So there are studies going on there, and they're saying that we're having an awful lot of melt, and there's also what we call sublimation melt. That's ice evaporating directly without melting first. And then you have all this melt that's going into what are called moulins. Moulin is a crack that goes straight down, plus crevices. And it's creating gigantic pools of water at the bottom. And when you have that much, you've got problems. You've got thousands of feet thick glaciers, 10 billion cubic feet of ice per day, or nearly 50 million tons of ice per day. That's a whole lot that's going on in Iceland. So, and then they had a 27,000 square mile area that they found that was 2,600 feet deep, and it's not firm anymore, and hence it's not like the water that's frozen. It's bad to the bone, and also it contains a whole lot of soot and a whole lot of dust from previous times. So now you got brown ice, and brown ice absorbs the heat where white ice reflects the heat back. You want white ice to reflect the sun back in the atmosphere, because when it's brown from dirt, it absorbs and that creates further warming. So my prediction is that we're going to see both in Antarctica and in Greenland major calving, and then you'll start to see major chunks starting to crack and move towards the water. It might be in a year, might be in 5 years, but you're not going to have major catastrophes of the ocean rising 10 feet in 100, 150 years from now. I believe it's going to be in the relatively near future. Now, concerning the droughts that we're having, the newest information comes that California is in a mega drought, and it's going to be a long drought, a minimum of 30 years. That means that for the over 1,000 communities that are low or out of water completely, and the federal government's turned off water to them, no longer giving allotments, better find another place to live, because there's just not enough water coming now or in the future for everything and everyone, not for industry, not for living, and not for agriculture. So the very rich, the powerful, the biggest industries, they will always be taken care of with whatever allotments will go to them first. But for everyone else, all those divisions, subdivisions, all those bedroom communities, I would suggest find another place to live in another state. It's not going to get better in your lifetime. But there's something else about the mega drought. This is from Dar Jamil from Truthout. Quote, scientists are now mapping a world that is changing rapidly in often terrifying ways. Climate disruption and world leaders' unwillingness to act have put us at risk of experiencing mega droughts, the disappearance of coral reefs, and other ecological impacts of the anthropogenically warming planet. The UN World Meteorological Organization recently announced that 14 of the 15 hottest years ever recorded have occurred since 2000. Ponder that for a moment before going further. In what is perhaps eerily prophetic timing, this February marked the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's warning about carbon dioxide. In a 1965 special message to Congress, he warned about the buildup of carbon dioxide and said, in what would become the harbinger warning of anthropogenic climate disruption, quote, air pollution is no longer confined to isolated places. This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through radioactive materials and a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. So, after the single worst mountaineering accident in history took place last summer on Mount Everest, the standard climbing route for that mountain has become off limits. Many mountaineers, including Jamil, credited with making the section where the deadly accident occurred more dangerous than ever before. An increasing number of reports now demonstrate that you have all forms of man-made climate change that we're not paying attention to, and we better start paying attention to it. Our water, our soil, everything is being affected. So I'm going to be doing a one-week special on the environment. Everything that's happening, I'm bringing in the best experts in the world from all over the world to give you what is now the 12 tipping points. Four of those tipping points have tipped. They cannot be reversed. The others are tipping and will tip, but we can do something about it. And it'll be a one-week special. And by the way, our lungs of the planet are dying. From Tom Hartman, quote, trees are like our planet's lungs. Every second of every day, they're absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and converting it into energy. In fact, according to a study by researchers at NASA last year, tropical rainforests absorb a staggering 1.4 billion metric tons of CO2 from the Earth's atmosphere. Through the process of photosynthesis, they're inhaling that CO2 and keeping it from further damaging our planet and speeding up the process of climate change. Photosynthesis is a process used by trees and other plants to convert sunlight into chemical energy that can be used later as fuel. During photosynthesis, plants absorb CO2, which is combined with water, H2O, to produce a mixture of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen called carbohydrates, everything from roots to stems to leaves to fruits. And by absorbing and binding the carbon and carbon dioxide, that way our planet's tropical rainforests are an invaluable line of defense in the fight against global warming and climate change. But unfortunately, new studies are showing that that defense is weakening. Our planet's lungs are dying. For the first time in history, scientists have been able to determine the rate at which trees In the Amazon, rainforests can absorb carbon during periods of drought. Scientists have known for a while that a drought can impact an individual tree's ability to inhale carbon, but now we know just how big that impact is. Researchers looked at the growth of and photosynthesis rates of trees in 13 different Amazon rainforest locations throughout Brazil, Peru, and Bolivia, and some of these locations were affected by severe drought in 2010 and some weren't. The researchers found that trees in areas that were affected by the 2010 drought had much lower photosynthesis rates than trees in areas that were not. And they were also in poor overall health than their drought-free companions. So, another reason we should be concerned. I'm Gary Nall. Let's now go over and say hello to Peter. Hi, Peter. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Peter, I'd like to begin with the history and role of Islam in the United States, and let me explain why. Because the current aggression between the religions of Israel, Judaism, and Christianity, and Islam, has become a regular daily feature in American media. And what I find is also exciting in the history of religion is that old myths are constantly being debunked when new information arises, and our textbooks need to be seriously rewritten. The example of Columbus as a hero and founder of the Americas is just one, and we continue to celebrate his adventure in the New World with a national holiday. On the other hand, his actions prove he was a messianic and ruthless tyrant. He was a genocidalist. Your research contributes to this need today to reevaluate the role and place of religion since the nation's founding, and one subject is the place Islam held in the Americas even before the founding of the nation. There were thousands of Muslim slaves brought over here, and in one in particular, a Moroccan-born Muslim slave, Zamari, who traveled with the conquistadors in search of the legendary Seven Cities of Gold, went on to become a healer and medicine man of sorts among the Native Americans, and may still be honored today by the southwestern Zunai culture as a divine spirit. So please take your time and provide us with an overview of the presence of Islam in the history of the United States since its first colonization by Europeans, including the views of early 19th century abolitionists who viewed Islam's spiritual ethics regarding the treatment of slaves as more humane and honorable than their counterpart Christian slave owners. The forum is yours.
Oh, I'll be happy to. Thank you. And you know, I was interested in your introduction when you were talking about the glaciers, because one thing that really moves at a glacial pace in American culture is the difficulty or the an inability to correct historical misinformation. Historical illiteracy is endures in a way that no matter how much research we throw at it, it still is very stubborn. And so what I hope to do with this book, with One Nation Under Gods, is to make my own contribution to correcting misinformation that is out there. And one of the most crucial ways in which I hope to do that is if you look at the news lately, you'll see nearly every day there is another new incident involving Muslims in America being harassed, their mosques being vandalized. In North Carolina recently, even three young Muslim students were murdered. Apparently with some connection to their faith as a motive. And one thing that we hear again and again surrounding these incidents is that there's this sense among many Americans that Muslims are newly here, that this is a new situation in American culture. We heard the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, even refer to Muslim immigration, in fact, as being an invasion. Well, when you begin to look at the history of Muslims in America, both in the United States and in the colonial era, you discover that to begin with Bobby Jindal's state, there were Muslims in Louisiana before the Louisiana Purchase. Slave owners made a point of bringing Muslims in to work on their plantations because of their expertise with the cultivation of indigo and rice and cotton. And so Muslims were part of American culture even before the United States began. You mentioned the explorer, Mustafa Zamori, who's often known by the name Estevancio, Little Stephen. This is a fellow born in Morocco around the time when Europeans were beginning to invade. and they invaded his city of Asamoah in around 1513 when he was just a teenager. And it was that point he was taken captive, brought to Portugal and Spain, eventually converted to Catholicism, perhaps only in name, as a pro forma baptism, and then brought to the Americas. But what the Spanish couldn't know when they brought him over is that despite the fact that they had passed laws by that point prohibiting the importation of Muslims into the New World because they feared they might spiritually contaminate the indigenous population, what they could not know is that a man like Mustafa Zamori had been raised in a culture, and this is his city of Asamoah in Morocco, that was in constantly blending and syncretizing different religious practices. And so this was a man whose very survival came to depend on his ability to move through these different religious worlds, from the Islamic world in which he was raised into the Catholic world into which he was taken by force, and eventually into the Native American realm. His story was that traveling with a Spanish expedition later in the 16th century, he was shipwrecked with several others, and they spent about 7 years wandering through the Americas, often being taken prisoner by different Native American tribes. And eventually he managed to win his freedom. He was asked by two Franciscan friars to lead them and eventually other conquistadors to the fabled cities of gold. And he set off on his own into the wilderness, eventually gathered around him a community of Native Americans who believed that he had great power and was a healer. And the end of his life is somewhat mysterious, but it seems to have involved this blending of cultures and traditions that he had learned throughout his life. And a real part of that, certainly, was the Muslim faith with which he was raised. So here is a man from the Muslim world who was part of American culture long before the Pilgrims, long before the Puritans, long before these iconic figures that we think of as being those who brought religions from the old world into the new. And here is a man who brought a different story, whose story was here from the beginning. And he in this was not at all alone. He represents just one of the perhaps 20% of enslaved Africans brought to the Americas who were followers of Islam at the time they arrived. And we've forgotten their existence here in part because the role of religion early in slavery has mostly been replaced in popular memory by the role of race, which is actually a later construction. Before race became the determining factor in whether or not someone would be enslaved, it was largely based on religion. The English colonists believed that at first they could not legally enslave Christians, and so they sought out not only Muslims but what they called pagans. And only as laws changed through the colonial era did they decide that, in fact, if they were able to convert their slaves to Christianity, they would have a better sense of control over them. And yet, though that mass conversion did begin and happen to the enslaved population, many of them were able to maintain their sense of being Muslims. And their stories turn up again and again, both through the colonial era and in early America. One such enslaved Muslim who became particularly well known is a man named Omar ibn Sayyid, who was 37 years old when he was captured and enslaved in what is now Senegal. He was brought to the Carolinas, and he was in the service under the yoke of a man he called a kafir, an infidel, who was a cruel master, and eventually led him to escape. And when he escaped, he was eventually captured and put into a jail cell in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And the fascinating thing that happened to him while he was there was that he became quite a public spectacle. People were very curious about this man because by then it was unusual for the residents of Fayetteville to meet a slave who had come directly from Africa. It was no longer legal to import human beings directly from Africa, so most of the slaves people would meet were born here in the United States. And so here was this man in the local jail cell, and people began to see that he had a strange way about it that they had never seen. He prayed five times a day. He spoke and prayed in a language they had never heard. And he eventually was able to find a piece of charcoal on the ground by the fire they used to help him have some warmth in this jail cell. And he began to fill his jail cell walls with Arabic script. He began to write verses of the Quran that he had memorized all through his life on the jail cell walls as a way of externalizing his prayer and perhaps protesting that he had now been enslaved in a Christian land. Umar ibn Sayyid eventually was released from this jail cell and returned to slavery. And over the course of his long life, he lived from the 1770s until the 1860s. He was eventually converted to Christianity. But it does seem that his conversion was much like the conversion of Mustafa Zamori, which is to say that it was pro forma. It was in name alone. He maintained many of his Islamic religious practices. He maintained his sense of connection to the Quran, the holy book that he had spent decades of his life memorizing. And though he became known eventually as someone who would go to church with his new owners in North Carolina, he remained loyal to the faith with which he was raised throughout his life. And this is a story you hear about many enslaved Muslims in the Americas, that they eventually were converted to Christianity. But the faith that seemed truest to them, the faith that seemed most personal to them, continued to exist underground. Now, the presence of slaves in the United States is well known to scholars. And yet, very recently, when President Obama mentioned at the conference on preventing violent extremism that Islam has been woven into the fabric of the United States from the beginning, this comment was met with just incredulous outrage from many who would not believe that this was ever the case. And in fact, Islam was influential not only in the sense that there were actual Muslims here, but it also played a role in the shaping of American ways of dealing with contentious issues of the day. You mentioned, for example, abolitionists. Early abolitionists looked to Islam and presented stories of Islam as a way of, they hoped, improving the lot of the slaves who were here in the Americas owned by Christian masters. So you would find, for example, abolitionist newspapers in New England published accounts of the lives of slaves in Islamic lands, and they would make the case that slaves owned by Muslims were actually treated better by slaves owned by Christians. And whether this was true or not, it shows that in this early American imagination about Islam, it presented a kind of alternate reality in which you could use the moral lessons of another faith to enlighten and perhaps to shame Christians who were not living up to the ideals of their own. So you find this, again, for centuries in American history. So the notion that Islam is a new immigrant faith that is an invasion, in the words of Bobby Jindal, is just not true to history. And it's difficult for many Americans to accept this because it seems to many to be an implicit challenge of their own, of their understanding of American history, the role of their own faith in American history. And it seems to me to present the possibility that one's own faith, the Christian faith that the majority of Americans identify with, that it was complicit in what happened to Islam in American history. That Christianity, as practiced in the slave states particularly, actively eradicated and replaced Islam that was brought by this powerless population. So to question or to retell the role of minority religions in American history is really a matter of reestablishing our entire understanding of how the nation founded, and really how we can think about these unpopular or challenging ideas today.
I appreciate these insights, Peter, because most people are probably not aware that approximately 20% of slaves in the southern colonies before the Revolutionary War were Muslim, and far outweighing the number of Jews and Catholics at the time. And among them were some notable figures, and Muslim slaves made efforts to preserve their faith even in captivity, as you just discussed. So when you look at the larger picture and avoid getting caught up in the differentiation between the free man and the slave, but focus instead on the large variety of people within these diverse religious backgrounds inhabiting North America, we cannot say that we were a Christian nation, because we weren't. We had many of these, and that's, it's good to know that. And also that there was a role for Jewish colonists played in the early shaping of the nation. And since Jews were constantly confronted with persecution during the course of their presence in Europe, it would seem obvious that many would have looked upon the new continent as an escape to freedom and start a new life of dignity. And there were some notable Jews who contributed to the founding of the United States, which furthers the argument that the U.S. is a fundamentally a multi-religious based enterprise. And religious purists argue against the cross-pollination and blending of different religious beliefs. They perceive it as a contamination and pollution. And today we hear this from the right-wing Christian contingent, who make delusional claims that yoga is demonic. I read that last week, and that it's a sin for Christians to practice it. Yet already in the early to mid-19th century, the Eastern faiths were making an impact upon the American religious landscape. Emerson, Thoreau, Melville were all deeply interested in the scriptures from the East. And barely anyone knows, for example, the impact Hinduism may have had on the liberation of women and the suffragette movement of the 19th century. So I'm happy that you're bringing this very important work out, One Nation Under God's A New American History, at this time, because it is needed. So I thank you very much, Peter Mansu, for being with us today and sharing your insights.
My real pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
His name is spelled Mansea-U, and his website is killingthebuddha.com. Also, petermansu.com. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.